I have to admit, when Dave contacted me and asked me to speak to you today, I wasn't sure if he was looking for a unique perspective on insects, or if he was looking for halftime entertainment or comedic relief. I wasn't sure, but I'm very excited to be here. I'm very grateful for the opportunity. My area of expertise is a little unorthodox in entomological circles. I have no formal training in entomology. In fact, my appreciation, even tolerance for insects, did come later in life. My education and career for 15 years was in what some might consider the polar opposite of entomology. I worked on both sides of the camera in fashion, advertising, and design. My work took me to locations in about 30 countries all over the world, and that's where my troubles began. From early childhood, I was phobic of insects. Though an artist in my youth, and a reptile fanatic, anything on more than four legs was anathema to me. My unfortunate condition took a decided turn for the worse when I decided to take an opportunity to serve as a missionary in northern Chile in the Atacama Desert. My first city was actually the driest spot in the world. In 400 years, they've never had a rainfall. So it was quite an unusual place. It was like living on the moon. There really wasn't any living organisms there, but people, dogs, and some really scary insects. My interactions with insects there seemed life-threatening. I'll forever have vivid memories of waking repeatedly in the middle of the night, covered in fleas. We had seven dogs living on our roof in one of my pensions, and they were not quite as hygienic as I would have hoped. And so I would run out of my room to the outside bathroom. There was a light on the outside of the door. I would turn on that light, and I'd hop back and forth covered in fleas, waiting for the fleas or for the giant roaches that covered the walls and the ceiling to scatter. And after a few seconds, as long as I could stand it, I'd break open the door, and there would always be about 10 or 12 or 15 behemoths that just refused to move. So I'd have to try to keep my eye on all of these different giant roaches while I picked the fleas and took off my clothes and grabbed the fleas and tried to throw them in the toilet, because of course you can't smash a flea. And you know, as bad as the fleas were, I think that if one of those roaches had decided to fly on me, that would have been the end. I never would have come home. So my condition, unfortunately, did not improve much when, after I returned from 2 years in northern Chile, I resumed my career in fashion in Southeast Asia. Let's see. It seemed that everywhere I went, horrifying insects were seeking me out and looking for opportunities to shorten my lifespan. My roommates in Taipei thought it was hilarious that I had to stand outside of our apartment building and yelling up to the third floor for someone to come downstairs and scare the tarantula that was off on the stairs away so that I could actually come into our apartment. It was pretty pathetic. Then on a particular sourcing mission for the Donna Karan Couture label in Bangkok, I wandered out into a local night market. Wedged between the vendors of copy watches and fake Prada bags, I noticed a group of artisans selling the most horrific creatures I had ever seen. I was instantly repulsed, but I was also shocked to feel, for the first time in my life, a surging fascination. I had never had the opportunity to experience arthropods in a static environment. These at least appeared to be dead, so I felt like I could examine them for the first time in my life without the threat of reprisal. I was struck by the design of these horrible little monsters. I marveled at their textures, and I wondered at their mechanics. What did all the little palps do? Why so many legs? Who knew that beetles the size of baseballs hid bat-like wings under their carapace? It was a pivotal experience for me. As a young artist, the macabre and the fantastical had always been my subject matter of choice. Even after years of in fashion, though I spent my waking hours poring over layouts of beautiful products and people, if I had free time to draw or paint, I was always creating some fantastical creature. Well, here they were. I felt that I really couldn't improve upon the horrors I was viewing that night at the Patpong market. So I bought as many as I could travel, as I could carry, and from then on I collected framed insects in each country I worked in. My embryonic desire to know more about these intriguing creatures was temporarily pacified by seeking out insect-related curios in the countries I visited. I was acquiring quite a collection of amazing specimens, though shabbily framed and inadequately preserved. I noticed that my taste was slowly morphing from the kind of morbid fascination that drives 10-year-olds to poke a stick at a particularly juicy piece of roadkill to an earnest appreciation for an ever-increasing variety of arthropods, even the classically beautiful ones. The second major step in the development of this new direction for me came after a jaunt in South Africa working for a UK clothing company. There, the natural elements were an inextricable part of contemporary design, and I began to feel a real desire to not only improve upon the thoughtless presentation of these creatures, but to share my finds with others. I finally worked up the courage to break open some of my curios and scrape out the insects in an attempt to make something presentable enough to hang on my own walls. At first, I couldn't even come close to touching these creatures. I practically used tweezers to handle the tweezers that were moving the specimens, but this didn't last for very long. In a matter of months, I had made up several very rudimentary pieces, which I wouldn't give away now, by the way. And I had also discovered BioQuip and Gardena, where Jerry Larson was kind enough to give me a few tips on how to spread a butterfly. This was in the pre-internet days, so though there were a few notable dry specimen catalogs, and I don't know if this brings back memories for anyone else, like Combined Scientific, I determined that it would be necessary for me to retrace my travels with a new purpose in mind, that of finding my own specimens to work with. My first major collecting excursion was a baptism of fire. I had merely intended to find some local catchers in Peru and buy some specimens to bring home, but I ended up meeting a well-known lepidopterist from Iquitos named Mario Caligari, who's now deceased. He convinced me that if I really wanted to experience the insects in the area, I'd need to be a bit more hands-on. So we took an 11-hour chicken bus to the tiny burg of Satipo, and from there we traveled with his brother Ivan for about 4 hours by four-wheel drive into the jungle to a secret spot that he knew of in the Junin province. After crossing a number of rivers and hours from the nearest phone, we came to some tribal lands and paid our dues to the local chief, who granted permission for us to enter. There, woefully unprepared, we hiked in about an hour to a small sandy bank of Amazon tributary that was virtually alive with butterflies. Agrias, papilios, morphos, you hardly even needed a net to capture them. I was amazed at the beauty of the place and intrigued when Mario informed me that his family had been collecting and employing some of the local tribesmen as catchers right there on that 100-meter bank for 9 years, and their take had only increased each year. As night began to fall, I realized that I hadn't brought a flashlight, enough food, and I was already out of water. Then the night species began to emerge en masse, and I began to understand the inestimable value of a good guide, and that I was nowhere near the intrepid explorer that I had imagined myself to be. Thankfully, Mario had a flashlight. He sterilized some murky river water with wild lime, and Ivan shot a small antelope. I thanked God for a competent friend and determined to be more prepared next time. Scary though that trip was for me, from then on, I couldn't imagine working in any other field or designing with any other medium. Insects were the embodiment of all the drama, beauty, and enigma I had ever hoped to capture in my drawings and paintings. As a collector at heart, the unending variety was enthralling to me. As a lover of nature, the sourcing of specimens became one of the most enjoyable aspects of my work. I continued making trips to countries in Central and South America and Asia, familiarizing myself with local species and developing relationships with native catchers, entomologists, and institutions in order to facilitate my supply lines. Perhaps more importantly to my fledgling clientele, I was at this time working to develop a style that I hoped would remove some of the creepiness that I knew would be felt by many at their first close encounter with an exotic insect. I wanted to provide an opportunity for the neophyte to appreciate form, structure, and color, and texture before any aversion to the subject matter was able to taint the experience. I also needed to honor the weighty use of once living organisms with an elegant, respectful presentation. Initially, my instinct was to simply prepare single specimens in the most inorganically symmetrical way I could, and then present them in an antiseptic white display. I always loved the simplicity of line provided by the cuts in double thick mat board, and I felt this geometric accoutrement completed the inorganic arrangement. Any imperfection in the specimen or irregularity in the preparation that reminds the viewer that the subject belongs to the unpredictable family known as bugs was and is unwelcome. The immaculate exhibition of a single specimen soon morphed into simple groupings of a few species sharing a common trait that could provide a discernible through line of design. My intent was merely to intimate at the nearly infinite variety that insects exhibit. Later, more elaborate pieces utilize simple repetition. The element of repetition is a particularly effective tool for removing insects as far as possible from their natural context, leaving the viewer free to enjoy studies in line and pattern while minimizing the potential creepiness of the subject matter. Repetition does this by both creating an overall inorganic pattern and by imposing more order and geometry than erratic insects would ever conform to. This element results in perhaps our most approachable pieces for the initially inhibited. Later experiments in marrying the divergent worlds of controlled, elegant presentation and radical morphological variety resulted in the mosaics and the coterie line. Here the focus is on diversity, with one or more universal elements adding cohesion to a piece to prevent it from devolving into an incongruent mess. In the Coleoptera and Lepidoptera mosaics, the defining element is brilliant, rich color. In the coterie pieces, the unifying element can be mandibles, frontal projections, abdomens, or wings. These works are much more challenging than previous endeavors, especially in finding ways to execute in production pieces that cannot be simply duplicated. Consequently, they require more subjective artistic skill than most of the insect pieces I design, and I train the artists that I employ longer on these pieces than on any others. Lastly, pieces that utilize both elements of repetition and variation are effective in a different way. Patterns can be established that offer a bit more intrigue as similar or complementary species form a morphing palette of color or texture without varying from a standard shape. Here also, I'm a little behind here. Here also, the Prism series shows off the unearthly hues of the insect world while reining in bugginess through geometry. Kaleidoscopic successions of complementary or discordant color are the dominant feature in some of my most effective pieces. Similarly, texture can be the isolated variant, while leaving the rest of the elements in the composition virtually unchanged. Early in the process of developing my ouvroir, I took advantage of some inexpensive rent in a high traffic area in Hermosa Beach and opened a tiny gallery. Expecting to only last through the holidays, and if I had known that I was going to last longer than that, I would have spent more than $500 on the remodel. I was pleasantly surprised at the consistent response we received. We stayed in that location for 2.5 years before deciding to move to Oregon and focus exclusively on our wholesale business. Today, Pheromone is still a US-based company, but we have a presence in several countries in Asia, and plans for European distribution are in the works now. We employ a number of artists in the US and Malaysia who reproduce my designs, and a number of dedicated catchers in various parts of the world. I want to talk for a minute about some of these guys. Some of these people I work with have just become the dearest friends. One in particular that I'll tell you about. The guy on your left, Sawai, with the orange jockstrap there, he's quite a nut. He is a very, very accomplished Cerambycidae expert. I think he's named around 100 species. He's a Japanese guy, and he works particularly with us in Borneo. The guy in the middle is named Mr. Liu. He's a Malaysian wildlife official. At times, some of the wildlife officials will go with us on some of our excursions to kind of get firsthand view of exactly what is going on with populations, and to either confirm or refute some of the stories they're hearing about depleted numbers or abundant numbers of certain species. The guy on the right is Denon Ng, who is my partner and one of my dearest friends. He's a remarkable individual, very, very talented, very knowledgeable in all different aspects of wildlife. In fact, about 4 years ago, he and one of his associates discovered the 16th species of Rafflesia, which are the largest flowers in the world, the ones that smell like rotting meat, which was quite an accomplishment. This is one of our birdwing breeders and specialists in Surabaya. No, in Sulawesi, I'm sorry. This is Jasmine. He's one of our best catchers. He's going after Chrysochroa chonggi, which is a very, very rare species in West Malaysia, and their host tree is quite high, and they never descend from the tops of those host trees. There's Denon and Jimmy Chu. Jimmy and his brother Stephen is a doctor in entomology, and they have been instrumental in really developing entomological understanding in Borneo. I think they've described about 40 different species between the two of them. This is Basuki Ongo. He's a friend of mine and also a specialist and dealer. This is his house in Surabaya. And this is Noor. She is fantastic. She has been with us since right out of high school for about 10 years. Fantastic catcher. She's our office manager in Kuala Lumpur now, and a very, very talented gal. My partner Denon heads our studio in Kuala Lumpur, and I run our base in Salem, Oregon. We sell through hundreds of retailers, including some well-known companies such as Saks Fifth Avenue, Barney's, Williams-Sonoma Home, and a lot of smaller mom-and-pop galleries, designer showrooms, and furniture stores. We also run a 3,000-square-foot gallery in Salem, Oregon, where we showcase not only my work with insects, but with rare minerals, fossils, preserved carnivorous plants and orchids, mollusks, and sea creatures. If you're ever in the Salem area, please look me up. I would love to give you a little tour. It's kind of a neat place. But I find it noteworthy that our company's appeal is not confined to retail home goods. I've been surprised at the variety of interest from many disparate segments of our society and those abroad. Our press portfolio doesn't seem to have much of a cohesive theme. Audubon in the USA, and the Kyoto Journal in Japan, CBS Sunday Morning in the US, and Focus in Poland, the LA Times and the London Times, and the press genres have been equally divergent and frankly puzzling. The African American Ladies Home Journal Jones, Science News, textbooks, the famed Swiss jeweler Swarovski Gems is using a bunch of our images in their new catalog. Home design magazines, fashion magazines, photography magazines, lifestyle magazines, and a news magazine in the Czech Republic whose name I can't pronounce, if anyone can help me with that. The ubiquitous interest in this type of work is a subject that I believe is worthy of some exploration. In part, this attraction could be explained simply by man's innate need for a connection with nature. Dr. Edward Wilson wrote extensively about the biophilia hypothesis, which seeks to explain the bond man naturally feels with other living systems. Wilson's hypothesis, simply stated, is that because of our biological genealogy, we feel a kinship with nature and with other non-human life forms. However, in this and similar explorations of man's innate need to experience the natural world, contradictions arise when arthropods are the natural element. Right out of the gate, the literal definition of biophilia is a love of life or life systems, but obviously entomophobia is much more prevalent than entomophilia, or at least it gets a lot more press. In the minds of many, there is nothing more quintessentially natural than erratic, archaic insects. And yet there does not seem to be an overabundance of romance aimed at them, and nor a lot of therapy effectuated by their use. It seems to me that though this and similar theories proposed by evolutionary psychologists may partially explain the pervasive attention this work has received, there is another element to consider. This element I only began to discover and harness after I opened the Hermosa Beach Gallery. I had a small showroom in the front with my studio in the back. The ceilings were 10 feet tall, but the walls dividing my workspace from the front were only 8 feet tall. As I was a one-man show, there was not usually anyone in the front to greet patrons, and so I had the opportunity of listening to the uninhibited comments from thousands of people as they entered the gallery over 2.5 years. It was at times flattering and at times annoying to listen surreptitiously to what people really thought about my work. But most intriguing to me was the fact that nearly every person who entered, almost without exception, had been emotionally affected in some way by insects. I was amazed to discover that it wasn't just me. Nearly everyone I came into contact with had a bug story. Some were similar to mine, such as, you know, when I was a teenager, I was in the shower and this giant bug. Or my family and I were vacationing in Hawaii, and when we turned on the light from our hotel room, you couldn't believe it. I heard a lot of that I expected. But what I did not expect were stories laden with emotion where a person was deeply touched by an interaction with an insect. One woman came to speak to me at a book signing in San Francisco and tearfully expressed her appreciation for being able to have a way to remember her young daughter who had recently passed from leukemia. One of the great joys they had shared together was chasing after butterflies. I received an email just a week ago retelling the experience of a man with his business partner while dining at an outdoor bistro in San Antonio. In the middle of their lunch, a beetle that sounds like it was probably a jewel scarab flew into their salsa. He wrote of his unexpected feeling of compassion for the unfortunate beetle and the experience of trying to clean the salsa off the wings so that the creature could fly away. He and his partner were amazed at the beauty of the species, and it became a strong memory for them both for many years. An actress related to me an experience she had while performing on stage at Sundance in Utah when a large tiger swallowtail landed on her hand in the middle of a performance. She actually had done this, you know, it's some kind of a Shakespeare, whatever that is, and this tiger swallowtail landed on her hand. And would have stayed for, it stayed for over a minute. And she says it was all that she could do to stop the performance and just experience this butterfly in her hand, even though she was in front of a large audience. I wish I could say that all the experiences and comments that I hear are positive in nature, but if they're not. I've heard a few to the effect of, I adore these creatures and I would rather see you in that frame than that bug. So we get that every once in a while. But positive or negative, the continual theme in thousands of comments I've heard over the last 12 years has been that a physical interaction with an insect helped to form visceral feelings about the world of arthropods as a whole. This is different than man's innate need to connect with nature. With few exceptions, man's almost universally inadvertent interactions with arthropods has created a charged dynamic that seems to hold a special, if not always vaunted, place in our need for nature psyche. It differs from our interactions with other non-human life. Other forms of nature that we fear, sharks, bears, leopards, we generally do not come into contact with, and when we do, it makes the news. With other animals that we love or admire, we normally have planned or controlled interactions with, a tropical fish aquarium, a pet parrot, or an iguana. And with the rest of the animal world, we usually either experience it while hiking, in zoos, or on National Geographic, where we expect to encounter it. Not that there are never surprises in experiencing the animal kingdom, of course there are, but with insects, the surprises are the very essence of our experience. Few are the planned or even desired interactions with insects for the public at large, and yet they are frequent and happen in ways and places that are nearly impossible with other types of animals. In short, arthropods ignore our boundaries and resist our efforts to control them like no other phylum. There is a pervasive, uneasy familiarity with them, an unrequested intimacy that has tainted the human race against them while simultaneously needing to acknowledge their presence. Like an embarrassing uncle or a delinquent stepbrother, we don't necessarily want to have anything to do with them, but they're still family. This emotionally biofamiliar hypocrisy seems to stick in our collective craw. As I came to this realization that insects are in the psyche of most of the population in a class of nature by themselves, I came to see that entomology itself is a branch of zoology that is distinct in at least one unique way. It seems that other branches of zoology are chiefly concerned with understanding their respective subjects for their own sake, or for the sake of conserving them. The typical herpetologist studying monitor lizards wants to know about and catalog their life cycle or their breeding habits most commonly to understand their role in their respective ecology. Ornithologists might spend years studying wrens, parrots, or cockatoos, but usually in an effect to understand behavior, improve conservation, or perhaps better define evolution or instinct. The typical cetologist would be concerned with natural history of baleen whales in order to improve their conservation. In effect, other branches of zoology are more concerned with animals in their own right. But with arthropods, it's more about us. Not that there aren't some here with more typical zoological pursuits, but I would venture to guess that the vast majority of attendees at this conference are more concerned with how the insect world is affecting some aspect of human life. How they destroy our crops, infect our bodies, decimate our forests, why they eat our homes, how they transmit disease to us, what their life cycle tells us about a death or a crime. In the entomology world, perhaps more than any other branch of zoology, the focus is on us. As their effect on us is more ubiquitous than perhaps any other type of non-human animal, the emotional, psychological, even spiritual effects that arthropods have on us seem to me to be worthy of more scientific exploration. I've personally experienced the need to understand my feelings towards arthropods as I work through my own phobia, but I've also seen how deep-seated feelings about insects have affected other people emotionally and spiritually. We have a client who's a therapist specializing in the treatment of severely traumatized children. She regularly incorporates insect specimens in her therapy sessions. She role plays with her patients using the ugly bugs as the bad guys and the pretty bugs as the good guys. And she has found that for some reason insect specimens are a more effective vicarious role-playing medium for her patients than the traditional ones, for helping the children to be able to tell their stories. Famed scientists from Bernard de Brera to Charles Darwin tell of their most deeply held beliefs being confirmed, if not formed, by their experience with insects. And during the airing of the CBS Sunday Morning show that was referenced, our website, which our web hosting service assured us could support tens of thousands of simultaneous users, crashed from the volume of hits. The voluminous emails I received confirmed that my earlier interactions were not isolated incidents. It's apparent to me that the study of the emotional and psychological effects that insects have on us is yet one more worthy entomological pursuit. However, insects' most compelling dynamic, that of a dizzying diversity of species, is at once an impetus for this innately emotional reaction and a hindrance for processing it. The need that drove Linnaeus to create a system of order, a system to order the organisms in our natural world, is present in all humans. We need to be able to comprehend and to some extent catalog what we experience in nature. And arthropods are the most incomprehensible phylum of organisms. There's simply too much to take in. They range in color, size, shape, texture, mannerisms, and purpose like no other creatures. This dynamic at once fuels people's imaginations and suspicions about insects. It keeps most wary, yet, even if only subconsciously, intrigued. People need a translation. They need a way to reconcile the visceral feelings they have towards these enigmatic creatures with our need to order and understand our experiences. I believe that the simplest solution lies in the beauty of insects. Though, of course, the species I work with have always been aesthetically pleasing, in the same way that notes of a beautiful song can enter the heart and sway it almost without permission, I have found that my subjects must similarly be meticulously composed in order to make the translation intelligible for the public at large. Though our taxonomic method is well established, the average person hasn't the time or inclination to avail themselves of this intricate, sometimes baffling system. Something as simple and innate as man's perception of beauty can be employed to help make sense of the dizzying array of variety in the world of arthropods. We are more inclined to familiarize ourselves with that which is pleasing to us. It is a joy to experience beauty, even beauty with a bit of an edge. And once an appreciation for the aesthetics of insects is born, it's amazing how quickly old prejudices and stereotypes fall away. Even more interestingly, appreciation for the aesthetic of insects, in my opinion, seems to be somewhat viral. I've had countless comments from patrons to the effect that when they first experienced my work, they could understand the attraction to butterflies, but only after some exposure did the beetles start to capture their affections. My experience, of course, was the opposite. I initially came to acquire a taste for the slightly macabre creatures in order to satisfy my earlier passions for monsters, but only later did I come to adore the more universally appreciable insects like butterflies and buprestids. This is a common phenomenon. Once initial emotional barriers are breached, we find that we have the capacity to appreciate, even come to love, things we couldn't have tolerated before. When people begin to see beauty where they had previously seen only a mundane, distasteful, or even frightening world of arcane organisms, positive changes in people's perceptions of arthropods are sure to follow. And these beneficial changes are not only emotional or psychological in nature. Appreciation for the aesthetic of insects can be a catalyst for social, ecological, economic, scientific, even philanthropic activities that can potentially benefit man, insect populations, and the environment. For example, the Bug Fair at the Los Angeles Natural History Museum has become one of the museum's most successful annual social events, thrilling and educating thousands of patrons each year while strengthening the community of insect aficionados in Southern California. Successful insect collecting programs intent on combating poverty while encouraging ecological conservation have been established in Kenya, Papua New Guinea, Costa Rica, and several other countries. At Pheromone, we've been working on establishing a philanthropic network that would match insect collectors worldwide with native catchers from tropical underdeveloped countries. Indigenous people in areas of poverty or extremely limited employment opportunities would be aided in creating their own micro businesses and paired with insect buyers through a philanthropic network where safe transactions can take place and predatory middlemen can be eliminated. These kinds of activities, social, economic, philanthropic, and environmental, are all fueled chiefly by our perception of the beauty of insects. But even if there was little to no value to the scientific, environmental, or philanthropic communities, if the unique aesthetic properties of the myriad insect species does nothing more than expand the layman's appreciation for and love of the natural world and inspire joy and wonder, it is enough. It is the chief reason I do what I do, and it is the main reason why we are patronized in venues throughout the world. Our pieces and images bring people joy, and this, in and of itself, has great value. I almost completely agree with the famed quote of Baba Diom: "In the end, we will only conserve what we love. We will only love what we understand. We will only understand what we are taught." But the last line kind of rubs me the wrong way. I believe to some degree we will only understand what we experience. The general populace does not need to be led by the nose to know what to feel about the mysterious world of insects. However, they do need to have the opportunity to have comprehensible experiences with them, to be taught in a way that is intelligible for each individual. I'm confident that given the chance, these types of experiences will result in understanding. Understanding will lead to appreciation, awe, even love. And love of these amazing creatures will result in conservation and enrichment and joy. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Chris. And Chris would, I'm sure, entertain questions from the audience.
Or I could have been so thorough that it just leaves no. How do I cope with the dermestids? Well, that's a good question. I actually early on got wind of the problem with dermestids and book lice, and developed a way of hermetically sealing the pieces. So actually, we have a lifetime guarantee on every piece. If anything is ever infested or anything ever falls apart, for as long as it's owned, we'll always repair or replace it. So I haven't found anything that's really foolproof outside of a hermetic seal. Yes. Uh-huh. Oh, sure. Yeah, night collecting. Generally, the most effective way to collect at night is to haul generators, and we use a mercury vapor lamp. There's a few different species of lamps that have very, very high UV rays, and we will plug in the generator and the light, usually on a moonless night. On the side of a mountain is best for us, where there's a bit of a clearing, and shine the light onto the white sheet, and the rays will attract pretty much everything that's nocturnal in the area, and the UV rays actually, in my experience, somewhat intoxicate the insects as well, so it makes them a little bit easier to capture. And it's just kind of on a good night, it can just be a big smorgasbord of absolutely amazing material. I actually just got back two weeks ago from collecting in Malaysia and Java and Borneo, and we had some horrible nights, unfortunately. So I mean, you know, you can do all the work and show up and get nothing but about a billion flying ants or wasps, which is what we had on several nights. Yes? Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely, yeah. There's a number of studies that have been done about how the rarity of a species affects their ability to be collected, of course. I mean, it's somewhat obvious. But also, the species that the rare species are, okay, this may be somewhat controversial. In my opinion, there's not really very many rare species, as much as there are rare insect habitats or rare insect ecosystems where the insects can thrive. Generally, if you have, you know, a healthy pair of insects, you can have a healthy insect population. The problem exists when their habitat or their host plant is destroyed. And that's why insect collecting, in my opinion, can really be advantageous to insect populations. The more that you can make insects an economically viable, sustainable rainforest crop, the more economic pressure to develop their habitat and thereby destroy the species is reversed. A standing forest full of very, very valuable bugs can be more valuable than the lumber or the land to clear it and plant corn. And this has kind of been proved in the systems that have been developed in Papua New Guinea and Costa Rica and Kenya that I mentioned before. Is there another? Yes. I'm sorry? Very little. I've been through Africa a few times myself, but I've got a couple of great contacts and catchers there. One in Rwanda, a fantastic organization in Central African Republic, that's actually an orphanage that funds the orphanage through collecting. But I don't do much in Africa because, frankly, for my work, the biggest, most impressive beetles in general are Central and South American, and then the really beautiful Buprestids and Rutellids are either South American or Southeast Asian. So Africa is kind of a distant third continent for me. Oh, please. The themes. The general overarching theme is always trying to take insects as far as possible out of their natural context and trying to get them so that people actually see something that is beautiful or colorful or interesting before they even realize that it's an insect for the most part. And so the later themes, like the Cotri line where I have all the different, the mat mosaic, the mat openings where there's a single family that with an isolated characteristic. It's always an attempt to kind of impose some order on the radical variety in the insect world. And so that's generally the overarching theme, is trying to impose order and something intelligible for people that may not be attracted to insects initially. Yes? Collecting permits. Oh, big pain in the butt. We have to have a collecting permit and we have to have an export permit from the country of origin for each country we export from. And then U.S. Fish and Wildlife get the rubber glove treatment every import, and so we have to do import licenses and permits for with U.S. Fish and Wildlife on each importation. So at times we'll go through reams of paperwork trying to make sure we are following all the laws. Any other questions? Okay.
Thanks again.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
I have a. So stay here.
Okay.
Thanks very much again, Chris. And as a small token of our appreciation, we have a gift that we're going to.
Oh, thank you. Well, that's very kind of you. Thank you very much. Yeah. I appreciate that.
And again, Chris will be in the exhibit hall at the ESA booth for a book signing this afternoon. So stop by and see him.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, everybody, for coming.